You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow, Brandon
Sanderson, Robin Mobb,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is...
And Mr. Grant.
The Renegade Star Series, books 1-3 by J.N. Chaney. Jace Hughes is a renegade. That means taking almost any job that comes his way, no matter the situation. So long as he can keep his ship floating, he's free to live the life he wants. But that all changes when he meets Abigail Pryor, a nun looking for safe passage out of the system. Too bad there's something off about the cargo she's carrying. Jace knows he shouldn't ask too many questions, but when odd sounds start coming from inside the large metal box, he can't help but check it out. Big mistake. The Renegade Star box set includes the first three books in the series, 900 plus pages, 300 five-star reviews and counting. Find out why people are so intrigued by this thrilling science fiction epic. You won't believe the twists and turns this series takes, or the secrets that get revealed. The Renegade Star Series by J.N. Chaney. Devin Ford, Recon, the Expansion Series, Book 1. Hundreds of years in Earth's future sees the United Global Territories striving to colonize the Moon and Mars. The discovery of a clean energy source ended the world's reliance on fossil fuels overnight, and years after the resulting wars, a new discovery puts the tenuous world peace at risk, that of faster-than-light travel. With humanity on the verge of traveling to new solar systems and all the humanitarian and scientific possibilities involved, a discovery by the reconnaissance team turns everything upside down. Join the small team of the reconnaissance mission who fight friend and foe to complete their mission objectives, no matter where it leads them or what the personal cost. Devin Ford, Recon, the Expansion Series, Book 1. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Anissa Gray on the show with me today. Anissa is an Emmy and DuPont Columbia Award-winning journalist at CNN Worldwide. She has been a journalist for quite some time, and her brand new debut novel, The Care and Feeding of Ravenously Hungry Girls, is on sale today when we're recording this. So happy release day, Anissa.
Thank you very much. It's all quite exciting.
Yeah. We've got a lot to talk about, but before we formally kick things off, we begin the show with the same question each time. And that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Geez, I don't think I can peg it to an age, but I can tell you pretty much from the point I started, I learned to read. So maybe around, I don't know, 5 or 6. But yeah, I was a big reader as a kid, and I made up quite early in my mind that I wanted to be a novelist. It took me many years to pursue that, but that was where the idea was born.
But were you a ravenous reader? You said. Mm-hmm. What were some of the kinds of stories that really fired up your imagination?
I read quite broadly as a kid. I was a huge Judy Blume fan, so her Fudge books and Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. I also had a brief period where I was very much into romance novels. But I would say the first sort of literary book I ever read was The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison. And that had just a profound effect on me. And that sort of solidified this desire I had to be a novelist.
I'll tell you what, Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing and Super Fudge changed my life. So, I feel a connection there with you.
We're on
the same wavelength. Absolutely. Absolutely. If I ever get to meet Judy Blume, I will have a tattered, fourth grade copy to get her to sign.
I don't know what reaction I would have if I met her. I mean, seriously, an emotional reaction, probably, because it was such a part. She was such a part of my childhood.
Exactly. And that's why two people who are old enough to have appreciated those are still talking about them. That's the power of story,
yep.
Isn't it? That,
yep.
We kind of laugh about those things as early influences, but they're deep and rooted.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if the one of the first books you pick up sort of captures you, you become a reader in that moment. You want to read more.
Right. You grew up as a pastor's daughter, is that right?
I did, yeah. My father is a, actually he's a bishop now in the largest African-American denomination in the world. And yeah, my mother was a homemaker.
Nice. Neither one of my parents were pastors, but I had a very religious upbringing and, in church every time the doors were open and in a very lively, church. And I remember as a kid, just the preaching and, especially visiting preachers that, that would come in and have this kind of, dynamism that would bring stories to life, to me that, that's a, in an increasing non-religious world. And, and that's an entirely different, discussion, whatever, but, mm-hmm. There's something about those stories that have been passed on and the storytelling atmosphere of church. Did you ever have that connection in realizing the importance of that storytelling tradition?
Oh, absolutely. That is sort of I'm not an evangelical Christian these days, but that's how I was raised.
Right.
But sort of that need to believe is sort of feels like it's sort of in my DNA based on how I was raised. But to your point about storytelling, the father in this book is a traveling evangelist. And as you point out, an evangelist would sweep into the church for, at least in my church, they'd, run a revival for a week, and it would just be magnificent in terms of how they told stories, in terms of how they connected with the congregation. So there's just this real, as you said, dynamism associated with church as I grew up understanding it. And some of that finds its way into the book.
Sure. What was the initial draw for you to journalism?
Really a steady paycheck, to be honest, after I graduated from college. I still had that dream of becoming a novelist, but I had student loan debt. And I knew I was a pretty good writer. So that was the direction I went off in my career, and I absolutely loved it. But I reached a point in my career where I started to feel a little bit burned out, and that's when I went back to try to explore in a serious way that dream of being a novelist.
So the whole time growing up and into college, that desire to tell stories and to be a novelist, that never left you?
No, it didn't. In fact, I spent a lot of time just writing, short stories and, a little bit of poetry. Not much to speak of, but mostly short stories and a couple of attempts at a novel just for myself. So, yes, that was always with me.
You began as a print journalist, right?
Mm-hmm, at Reuters, covering economics and monetary policy, a lot of dry stuff that doesn't necessarily, on the face of it, lend itself to storytelling. But
yeah, but that's the mark of a great journalist, is to take something dry that we don't necessarily want to listen to, and you mm-hmm. communicate that to us in such a compelling way that we want to know about the people involved and who this is affecting and kind of what the global scale of things is. When you're getting into it and you realize, oh, this is kind of boring, dry stuff, how do you start interjecting, into the dry stuff to make it, palatable for people?
I think the first way is to find that human element. So while I may, mention monetary policy, and that may mean absolutely nothing to you or to the next person, when I start telling you about your interest rate on your home loan, how that's going to affect your finances, how that's going to affect your family, then that becomes a very personal story and you care about monetary policy.
Right, right. In those early days, was there a particular story that kind of woke that up for you, that you realize, oh, okay, this is where a human connection comes?
I can't really point to a specific story, but I can say I grew up watching the news with my dad, and this is sort of what sort of sparked an interest in journalism. And seeing, you know, I grew up in a fairly smallish town, and seeing lives that were different from mine, and oftentimes that were much more difficult than mine, it sort of sparked something in me to want to be part of telling those stories.
Right. Where did you grow up? What part of the country?
I grew up in Michigan, in western Michigan, on a little town called Muskegon on Lake Michigan.
Gotcha. And you moved to New York and began your career there. What was that move like for you, coming from a smaller town, more Midwest, and then coming to New York, the city that never sleeps and you know, millions of people around? What do you think that move did for you in maybe opening your eyes to the world, maybe the way you see other people, ultimately to your storytelling?
In a word, it was jarring, the move, but it was one I definitely wanted to make. And what it did was it opened my worldview. Growing up in a small town, you have, I grew up in a small sort of working class white community, actually. So I was, you know, one of the only black people there. So and I went to an African American church. So my pool of people, sort of a racial, you know, view was very small. Going to New York, I met just every kind of person from every religious group. I mean, people it's sort of what you would expect if you are willing to learn from someone who's not like you. It opens you up, and it helps you to connect more broadly and to fully understand that your story is most certainly not the only story.
Right, right. Did growing up in a community where you were not just a minority, but a glaring minority, that you're so outnumbered, how do you feel like that has affected the kinds of stories that you tell?
I think I tend to sort of look sort of beyond sort of the facade, beyond, this person is white, so they think this.
Right.
This person is black, so they think this. This person is Hispanic, so they think that. I'm less prone to sort of fall into that trap because I've known so many different people who are not like me racially, but have, you know, so many of the same things in common.
Right. You eventually made the move from print journalism over to CNN, where you, like we mentioned earlier, won an Emmy, other awards. What was the move from print journalism to more visual journalism? How did you make the move, and how is the process different for you?
It was quite a learning curve going from, you know, just purely print, where, you know, all you have are your words to tell the story, and then going into a visual medium. So it took some learning, and it's quite different because you have the pictures and you have the sound, and that sort of helps you as a writer to convey meaning. So it was quite a learning process, but I deeply enjoyed it and stayed with it. I never went back to print.
It's, I would imagine once you've kind of had a taste of getting to really connect with a broader story like that, it would be difficult to go back.
With respect, broader story, because you can tell broad stories in print, and, you know, there are some wonderful big magazine pieces. It's just a different way of telling a story.
Sure. More visceral, more, especially for the climate that we're in, where we're vying for people's attention. If we can get the most emotional impact in a a tighter package with visuals and sound and all that, that has to be enticing.
Yeah. So the difference between, you know, bringing someone into the room and painting a picture with the words rather than showing them the room and having them hear the sound, which can be a little bit more immersive experience. It's vastly different.
So you're working in journalism. You've spent several years there. You're having success. You're telling stories that matter. What is the draw that brings you back? Brings the desire to write fiction back to you?
Well, I reached a point in my career where I was feeling a little bit burned out. You know, I enjoyed what I was doing, but I felt like I had sort of reached a ceiling. And I thought I could do more, but in a different form. And I'd always had the desire to write novels. And novels are sort of their own unique animal. And I was just excited about taking it on and trying to do it in a serious way.
So how did you begin? Did you have an idea for a story? Was the Butler family, did they come to you first? How did the story that you that became the care and feeding of ravenously hungry girls, how did that begin to grow in you?
It was more of an evolution of an idea. I started first with the character Viola, and what I was interested in doing was just telling the story about her and her struggle with an eating disorder. But that story just wasn't coming together. It was just sort of dead on the page. So what I did was I sort of took a step back and I started to look at her through the lens of her loved ones, her siblings, her nieces. And that's when the story became something different. That's when the voices of her sisters actually became much more resonant. And it was a matter of sort of tuning my ear to that and allowing myself to be led in an unexpected direction, that Care and Feeding was born in the way it is now.
How long ago did the story start for you?
It took about 3 years to write. The first 6 months were sort of flailing away with that original idea. But once I realized that that wasn't viable and that I had a bigger, broader story, I essentially threw away 6 months worth of work and, yeah, that was easy. And,
oh, yeah.
And started over with this new story. And, it was, obviously the right thing to do.
You know, a lot of people, a lot of creative, types will, jot notes down all the time. Maybe we have an idea for something and let me just write this down in this notebook and maybe one day it'll be something. And you know, I kind of have a file folder like that and I'd revisit it from time to time just to see if any of those random ideas kind of wake up to something. When did you know this is, okay, this is the story? Like, you know, it goes from a character that, you know, there's something here. And then you said that you eventually threw away 6 months worth of work. What was, what was the thing that let you know, okay, this is the story?
I think it was when I heard, you know, the voices of her sisters in a very strong way. And I could see that they had their own stories to tell. And that's when it became a multi-character story. That was the big change.
Right. And to me, the story is, instead of a protagonist, the family is almost the protagonist, if that makes sense. Like they become a character in their multiplicity, they become a character. And that's a weird thing to say, but do you understand what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely. Sort of the family exists as a unit made up of these different parts. But the way it functions all depends on how well the different parts function. And we had some dysfunctional parts in this family. And it was a matter of fixing some of the things that were broken to repair the unit, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. As writers, we always put little pieces of ourselves in our characters, even though I think most writers are not writing, you know, thinly veiled autobiography. But a lot of times, you know, our pieces of us and our experience work into various characters, and sometimes 10 different characters will all have pieces of us, and we as the writers, the only ones that know that. How much did you draw on your personal experience in writing this book?
Yeah, probably a good bit. Certainly the Viola character, her experience with an eating disorder, that is based loosely on some of my own experiences in treatment. The religious aspects of it, as I mentioned, the father in this in the book is a traveling evangelist. I've known a great many traveling evangelists in my life. And just the idea of family itself, as you were just pointing out, the unit. I am one of five siblings, and a lot sort of goes on within a family, particularly in those sibling relationships. And I wanted to try to convey some of that complexity as well in the novel. So I would say in those areas, I definitely drew from some personal experience.
When you started writing, and you said you threw that 6 months worth of work away, and you began in earnest with the story, did you have a daily writing habit? What did you do to stay motivated with the story? You're probably working every day and have, you know, other important things going on in your life. How do you maintain this thing and keep its importance in your life?
One of the wonderful things about having spent my entire professional life as a journalist is that it has made me a disciplined writer. I can set a schedule and keep it. I don't wait for inspiration. I try to find inspiration after I sit down at the appointed time. So that just sort of my work ethic and work habits, that was tremendously important. So my schedule was to write on the weekends because, as you point out, yes, I worked every day in my day job.
Right, right. I've talked to a number of journalists that have gone on to write fiction, and we talk a lot about the tools of a journalist that invariably help them become fiction writers. And there's something that it's kind of magical to me. I don't necessarily have this gift. I'm sure I could work at it. The ability to do what a journalist does and seeing an event or happening or whatever, and being able to tell a unique story around it, especially when you're reporting on something that maybe, you know, four or five other outlets are also reporting on, and yet we can read all four or five of those accounts, and they're all a little different. They're conveying the same information, but they're finding that human element of the story that we talked about earlier, and finding a reason for me to connect with it. How do you feel that being a journalist has helped your fiction writing?
The sort of main qualifications, I think, for being a good journalist is to be observant, to pay attention to small details. And sometimes it's the small detail that changes a story or that makes someone connect with the story and that sets your story apart. Because you're right, there are, you know, a number of different news organizations. We are all telling the same story, but we're not all telling it the same way, and that's largely because you have some good journalists out there who are paying attention to the details and pulling those details forward and touching people in a way that, you know, another story told from a different perspective with far less detail or details that don't speak to them directly may not touch them.
In your new book, The Care and Feeding of Ravenously Hungry Girls, the Butler family, like all families, have been through some stuff. And, you know, when you have more than one person, you weather storms together. But you set up the story, for a serious, you know, possibly devastating event that happens to this family. Where did the idea for this come from? And were you ever surprised at how your characters reacted and formed this, this familial bond, in characters that are not actually real?
Well, where I got the idea of the sort of, you know, inciting incident, the crime was I'd heard about a couple who'd committed food stamp fraud. That's a much lesser crime than the couple in the book have committed. But it was a couple, and at their sentencing, the judge, they had children, so the judge decided that the husband would serve his sentence first, and then the wife would serve her sentence first. That way they would both, you know, it wouldn't disrupt the family that much. And I was interested in seeing, you know, what would happen if both parents are ripped away from their children? How would, and the rest of their family, how would that affect the family? So that was the sort of genesis of the idea for the crime and sort of the big moment that sort of ripples across, you know, it ripples through every member of the family. And to your question about was I surprised at how some of the characters reacted, yes, I was. That's sort of one of the beautiful, compelling parts of things about being a writer is that, you know, you create these characters, but in some ways they have a life of their own, and they can lead you down unexpected pathways. And in some ways it's as if they're doing and you're just recording. So that part of the process I find just endlessly fascinating.
It really is crazy that that we create these characters that exist only in our heads, and they really take on lives of their own. It's we're one of the few you know, artists that can get away with talking like that.
I know. Yeah, sometimes even I hear myself and I'm just like, okay, that sounds a little woo-woo, but I'm, you know, I'm just going to have to go with it.
right, exactly. You are no stranger, Anissa, to creating things and putting them out to the public. And, you know, when you write a piece of journalism, when you put together a package for CNN, and there comes a point where you have to take your hands off of it and it goes out to the world, and then you see if people receive it or not. I would imagine working in the industry, as long as you have, you, build up a pretty tough skin and, you know, can handle that. Is writing fiction and this thing that you created just out of whole cloth and then offer to the world, is the launch of that different than the other work you've done?
It is, yes. It's quite different. In journalism, it's often kind of a team effort. You know, you're writing for a correspondent or an anchor. And back in my days when I was a writer, so yes, those are your words, but a lot rests on how the anchor delivers those words. So you don't feel as personally, you know, responsible if things don't go well. But with a novel, that's all you. You know, at the end of the process, you have your editor, and I am lucky to have a wonderful editor at Berkeley. They, you know, sort of go through things with you, but these are all your words, these are all your characters, and oftentimes they have a personal connection to you. So you have a lot more, or at least in my case, I have a lot more invested in the novel, it feels. So hopefully the public will be kind.
Well, the care and feeding of ravenously hungry girls is a magnificent read. This, you immediately grabbed me in the opening chapter, and I never wanted to let go of this family. Anissa, if people are just learning about you and your work, is there a place where they can read more about you online, connect with you, and maybe follow along with the news coming up for the future?
Yes, you could go to my website at anissagray.com or follow me on Facebook and Instagram at Anissa Gray Author.
Excellent. We're going to send everybody to see you and to get their copy of the book. It's out everywhere now, The Care and Feeding of Ravenously Hungry Girls. Anissa Gray, thank you for taking time to come on the show with me today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Missing Wings by Andrea Luman. Born with an ability the Viladi people of Madar believe make her one of the first to be blessed by God, Katrina's destiny unravels when her father is poisoned and her mother steals her into the human world to hide among those who hate her kind. In a near-fatal attempt to return home, Katrina is stripped of her wings. The poison meant to kill her father leaves him in a degenerative state. When her eldest brother discovers she has survived, he orders her to stay in hiding. She must wait, concealed in the human world until the danger of their father's uncontrolled rages is contained. Grown and adapted to the human world, Katrina encounters one of her kind. The promise of home and the first love leads her into a situation capable of starting war among the Villadim. Will a human upbringing, mistakes, and the loss of her abilities bar her from reclaiming her heritage? Will unraveling the mystery of her mother's betrayal lead her family into an even greater danger? Missing Wings by Andrea Lumen. The Locust, books 1-3 by Ralph Kern. The complete Locust series, an epic tale of mystery, survival, exploration, intrigue, and war. The cruise ship MS Atlantica is lost. On these strange and uncharted seas where even the compass shows the sun rising to the west, Atlantica's passengers and crew must do what it takes to survive. In Unfathomed, Atlantica arrives in a strange new world. Unable to locate land with no way to contact home, they must find new allies, fend off relentless enemies, and discover the horrifying truth behind the Locust. The future of humanity will be decided as the fleet confronts the architect of the Locust. Not everyone will survive the desperate final battle. The Locust box set contains all three action-packed novels in this best-selling science fiction thriller series, Unfathomed, Expedition, and Osiris. Acclaimed for great characters, thrilling action, technical accuracy, and a compelling sense of mystery. Buy it today! The Complete Locust Series by Ralph Kern. Thanks for listening to the Author Stories Podcast. For more great author interviews like this one, go to hankgarner.com and dig through the archives. There's something there I know you'll love. Now stay tuned for a special audio clip from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane Series.
I'm melting! I'm melting!
Cried Joey.
Take the picture already!
He stood with one arm around the bronze waist of the bewitched tribute statue, Samantha Stevens, riding a broom across a crescent moon. Jason tried in vain to frame the shot without any tourists in it, but that was impossible. From all points of the compass, a merry horde had arrived for Salem's two-day summer psychic fair. All the commuter trains had burst open, like cornucopias filled beyond capacity, spilling endless fruits and nuts onto the red brick sidewalks of Essex Street. A vampirist in lavender shorts and feathered boots sold maple chocolate walnut fudge in front of the Witch City Tattoo Parlor. A near-naked gypsy in purple-green veils danced with a pheasant in her arms around a plug-in Hanukkah menorah. A fat man in a fetching blue jeans dress sold amethyst and citrine charm bracelets in front of Medusa Cafe, but his stand got knocked over by a one-armed crone driving a mobility scooter who sang, "Choo-choo," as she passed, her stump on the wheel, her lipstick ghastly, her gnarled right hand raised in trailing plumes of noxious cigarette smoke. Chewbacca leapt out of her way and slapped sparks from his fur. He gave a disgruntled growl before going back to playing Summer Lovin' on his ukulele. The old one-armed dervish drove off, choo-choo, parting a crowd of wanderers, slack-jawed tourists with camera straps tight across their bellies, yellow-vested police on segways, elderly rollerbladers, face-painted infants and harried parents, and college girls. So many hot, hysterical college girls that you'd think somebody had napalmed a sorority house.
Jason, are you deaf?
Sorry. Jason raised the phone and took the shot. Joey inspected the photo and nodded in approval.
Your turn.
No, thanks.
Do it, Shaggy. Don't make me hex you.
Jason gave in and traded places. He put an arm around Samantha's metal back. Her bronze body had flushed in the afternoon sun, warm through his glove, but her eyes were weary. No, downright creepy. And her smile was forced, like a Disneyland princess who'd had her toe stomped.
Say chowder,
cried Joey, who'd been practicing his New England accent all morning.
Come on, man. Say chowder.
Fine, chowder. Joey got the shot, and Jason surrendered Samantha to a chubby kid wearing a Gandalf beard who climbed up to worship her bronze bosom.